And many times, if you ask executives, you ask, are you doing consumer research? Are you going out and talk to the user yourself? They say, oh, yeah, of course we do insight. And I'm like, but who's doing the insight? You can't read bullet points in a PowerPoint 150-slide presentation and feel what the user's feeling.
We are Smart OSC. This is Commerce Talk, the podcast that keeps you one step ahead. I am your host, Aziz O'Byrne. Today, we are looking at problem-solving viral products with George Hartel. George is the Chief Commercial Officer at Sapara Group, looking after GQ Thailand, and he is also the co-founder of Fighting Giants, a space that helps leaders and businesses transform. With over 20 years of transformation and multinational business experience, George brings with him a very rare and refreshing outlook that challenges the status quo of traditional retail, advertising, marketing, and leadership. From advocating for more ugly advertising to removing the filters on what it takes to really understand your customer journeys and their needs, in this episode, we discuss all of that, as well as GQ's innovative transformation from a traditional fashion brand to a problem-solving tech brand, which has their name linked to some of the most viral product launches of the decade. Let's hear what George has to say. George, thank you so much for joining us on Commerce Talk. It's great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you, Aziza, for having me. And thank you to Smart OSC and the Commerce Talk team for allowing me to join today and share what we've been up to.
We are delighted to have you. Honestly, it's such a great pleasure to speak to you again. I'm going to start this off with a little icebreaker that we usually do with our guests. It is a chance to get to know you a little bit better because, as you know, you can learn a lot about a person based on their online purchasing behaviors. So, to help our audiences get to know you that a little bit better, I'm going to ask you to play a little game of Priceless and Pitfall. That is where I will ask you to tell us one priceless online purchase you've made that's brought unbelievable value to your life and a pitfall purchase that you've made, which you may have regretted in the end, or maybe it didn't serve you very well. So go ahead.
Wow. Okay. So I think if I'm thinking about a priceless one, one that I really have come to love is there's a really great executive audiobook summary program called Blinkist. Maybe some of your audience has heard of it. I find it to be this incredible tool that when I'm on the morning run in very hot Bangkok on a normal day, it's usually 30 degrees. These runs are great to just think about a topic that I'm interested in, and I'll download, you know, 5 or 10 books that are about it. They're like 20, 25 minute summaries sometimes, and then just blitz through a particular topic. And I've been doing this now for the last few years, and I find this just such a great way to like go really deep on a particular topic from a lot of different authors and get some nuggets to think about. Yeah. Some people will say, oh, you should read more books. And even my family sometimes will say this, and I do like books, but I like this, like these small sprints, and Blinkist has been an awesome purchase and tool for me to keep my mind fresh.
Beautiful. I love that. And it's like, you know, you should read more books. You're like, well, I've listened to 10,000 this year. So who's winning here?
Yeah.
So any pitfalls?
Oh, my biggest pitfall, you know, we're so immersed in D2C e-commerce all the time. So I'm a sucker as much as anyone for a good like conversion ad in Instagram or Facebook. And so I tend to click and buy a lot of these really kind of gadgety, like sometimes like really clever inventions that when you finally get they might not be quite what they sold you in the video. And I have a little bit of a history there of buying these things that they come in and then sometimes the packaging's a mess and then it's like not at all what you thought you were being sold. I think the worst one of all time is I bought an advent calendar of NBA players for my son that I thought was just a brilliant idea. And when it came in, it was like not even it wasn't even like NBA players. It was like little horses and like random toys that someone had stuffed into like an old advent calendar. So yeah, I think just being a sucker for this can be good, but it keeps me interested in some of their ads are pretty clever to create hooks and thumb stop online, which is quite helpful sometimes for e-commerce development.
A great hook, not a great execution, but
no repeat buyers for sure.
That's brilliant. So I think that says a lot about you. I think there's a curiosity in you. You've got a great curious streak. I'm wondering if that curiosity, is that the thing that brought you to Thailand in the beginning? And if so, what led you to where you are now today?
Yeah, you know, Thailand, I find is an amazing place. And I'm, you know, I'm really proud to call it home now. And but it didn't start that way. I grew up in the U.S., in New Orleans. And, you know, I was an engineering major. And I always had a really fond passion for, like, wanting to create things and grow. And I think that as I went through my career with Newell Brands in the U.S., and then eventually they asked me to come out to Asia to run the Asia business. And I was based in Bangkok. I just really just fell in love with the whole region more. And I was bouncing around between China and India and most of Southeast Asia. And then as a family, we really wanted to try to stay here. And we loved it. We all loved it, not just me professionally, but personally. We really, really loved the culture and the people of Thailand. So we opted to stay. We loved the kids' school. And then I started doing the same transformation work that I had been doing at Newell for like 15 years on, you know, so many brands and so many parts of the U.S. and the world. I got the opportunity to start doing that with Thai family businesses. And that's what led me here to TQ. And it's just been really rewarding, like professionally and personally, to now be able to really go deep in the market here in Thailand and do transformation and brand building and viral marketing and e-commerce with, you know, a very traditional Thai family business. And it's been quite a journey for the last, you know, now almost 5 years.
So exciting. And I think there's so much in that we're going to jump into as well as we go through this interview, especially the family business point. But I guess looking at GQ's history, you know, they have a 60-year history, as far as I know, that it shows a brand that has innovation and agility in their DNA, which I think has been seen a lot more over recent years. And before we kind of look at some of those viral product launches and the family business as a whole, I'm wondering that shift, because I've seen you speak about this shift between going from a primarily apparel focused brand to what it is now, which is a technical brand with problem solving at its core. How did that happen? Or what was that journey to getting there?
Yeah, this is a really important pivot that the business made. The exciting part was, you know, when I joined, when the CEO, who's a third generation technically leader in the company, he, you know, the foundation of what the business had done is like been core to like creating great products, right? And what we needed to do was to more or less forward integrate what was happening rather than being, and many times the historical part of the business had been like an OEM for big brands like Nike and Reebok and Under Armour and North Face Japan. So the quality and the capability was like there, but we were doing it for others. And The other piece was historically was always really much more like a typical fashion brand.
Yeah.
So it was like a lot of collections. Every quarter, every month is new series, hundreds, sometimes thousands of SKUs were launching, constantly needing to turn inventory, get ready for the new collection, a lot of long tail business. And so this business is not the best. Apparel is not a good business for like e-commerce in reality, right? Everybody that's involved in it struggles in it because it's long tail. You get a lot of dead stock. Markdowns are complicated. Returns are complicated. So we said, hey, could we do something different? And this is where we took the principles from the CPG world that came from, and we applied it for the first time to a apparel or fashion business. And we're very clear in our strategy and our purpose. We're like, we're not a fashion brand. Talk to agencies or partners who want to partner. They're like, oh, we love TQ. The things you're doing in the fashion category are great. And we're just like, be really clear, we're not a fashion brand. And we changed the strategy to really think about going out and doing insights with users. It wasn't about the design or the how it looked. Look is important. We're not like dismissing it. Like, it's important in our men's apparel world for men to look confident. But it's not about like strutting down the red carpet runway, just being confident enough to do the job today. But what was missing was like, no one was solving the real problems that
were happening in apparel across the categories. And so we went out like an FMCG or CPG business, whatever. We talked to users. We didn't use big research. We didn't talk to look at a bunch of online data that said apparel's growing, Thailand's an emerging market, that the apparel market is big. Like, you didn't need a report to tell you that. Like, it's kind of like common sense. So just go out and talk to users and say, what's the problem? And we wanted to forge the energy of the company and the people and the marketing and everything we were doing around a single product rather than a collection. And the first place we started with that was what is called GQ White, the ultimate white shirt. And when we talked to users, we were like, hey, what's going on with the white shirt? And I said, well, everything that anyone has ever worn a white shirt, including you, the biggest fear is that they're going to spill on it and get a stain. And you can't even get to your first meeting or interview or whatever you're doing. And so this was a really big, important understanding. And there was already readily available technologies in the world that could create a stain-proof shirt. So we kind of bundled it all together and created like a really powerful SKU and then bundled it with really great viral marketing. And we put the whole energy behind one product. And when we did that, we created a multiplier effect that on a normal shirt, white shirt, it would sell maybe 2,000 units in a month. The first 2 months that we launched, we sold 200,000 white shirts. But we didn't need the whole collection. You just sell one white, it was one SKU, 10 sizes, and we sold 200,000 plain white shirts. So what we did is we changed the whole mentality of the organization and the teams and even the market to go, wow, you can sell a single item. And guess what? We've been selling the same white shirt now for the last 4.5 years under the same model and continue to grow the white shirt category. And then we, you know, systematically went category by category in men's apparel and have done that. And so this single idea, this insight of the strategic shift to say, let's make apparel, let's make fashion tech apparel, let's make the business about insights-led product development and innovation, created this incredible multiplier effect for the brand. And it changed the perception of the brand from being, at the time, it was like an old uncle brand with those like striped polos that are quite popular in Asia, to now people consider us like a brand that's really doing innovative work. And that hasn't been that long, and there was COVID in the middle. So it's been a really remarkable transformation for the brand in such a short period of time.
Yeah, it's incredible. And even from my own perspective, I'm thinking of that white shirt, and this is why I'm wearing this jumper over this white top, because I was afraid that I was going to spill something on myself before we get to this interview.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
But in general, I think from the outside looking in, it seems like GQ is a brand that kind of swims against the stream. And when you're talking about, you know, that apparel framework of mass movements, color palettes, all of these things that you sit steadily within, whereas GQ kind of went against that and did a thing that not a lot of people do, which is a bit mind-blowing, which is just going against your assumptions, going directly to customers and just understanding their challenges and finding those lovely little nuggets of information to better help solve their problems. And I want to talk a bit about how you as a group were able to start moving through those changes, because it sounds like an easy solution. Let's talk directly to our customers, but it's something that doesn't always have the same rewards for a lot of companies, or maybe a lot of brands don't do the same thing. What made this success for you?
I do think that the playbook that we're running is very unique. And it's for me, it's not that I think the other brands aren't talking to consumers and they're not listening. I think that the issue that I see, and I think we'll talk more about this later a bit, is when I talk to brands and leaders, whether they're multinationals or they're family-run businesses, it doesn't matter. Their issues are really the same. And it wasn't any different here at GQ when we started the journey. Is there tends to be so many filters put on what's happening. And many times, if you ask executives, you ask, are you doing consumer research? Are you going out and talk to the user yourself? And I said, oh, yeah, of course we do insights. And I'm like, but who's doing the insights? And they're like, oh, well, we got an agency. The agency then farms it out to a key account manager who then sends it to this other person who then talks to the user. And that person filters what they have to say back to their boss and so on and so on. And by the time it gets to you, it's like broken down into a full bullet points. And so it's like that you can't read bullet points in a PowerPoint 150 slide presentation and feel what the user's feeling.
Yeah.
And, you know, someone recently said they spent an exorbitant amount of money. I think it was like 1.5 million baht. So about 50,000 US dollars roughly to get a research study back that said that people would like cool and comfortable apparel. And I was like, they're like, this is a really important driver for the category that people get cool. It's Bangkok. It's like 40 degrees most days, it feels like. Of course they want cool apparel. Everybody's hot and they would like it to be comfortable. Well, who wants uncomfortable clothes? Like no one.
You're never going to say you want uncomfortable clothes.
You didn't need a research study to do that, but they needed confirmation that people wanted cool and comfortable, but it's a waste of time and energy. And it doesn't actually give you anything you can work off of. You have to go and like figure out what to do with that. Well, now. So we've been able to create an environment here where we don't constantly put a filter on things that are morphing it into what I would consider kind of a watered down solution at the end that maybe everyone is like happy with, but at the end it doesn't need distinctness for the brand story and the brand message. So a lot of brands will talk about relevancy and differentiation and things like that, but we're talking about like the brand being really distinct in the market, right? Not just different, but really distinct. And that is played out, and we take the insights that we learned about a particular item, particular problem, and we use that message all the way through our product, our packaging, every touch point that the customer interacts with the actual, whether it's ads or it's the product, they are hearing the same wording that the consumer used when they described it originally.
Beautiful.
And we stay true to that all the time. And when we do that, it really, really resonates with people. And sometimes it doesn't make for the most beautiful ad, doesn't make for the prettiest copy.
Yeah.
But if you allow someone to make the copy look pretty or make the ad look pretty, you lose the authenticity of like what the brand is doing. So this is something that's been really important. That's really helped us stay distinct as possible.
That is that last point is a point that I really find so fascinating. And you've spoken about this before, which was, I saw a quote of yours, which is saying like, what looks good doesn't usually work well in Thailand. And I'd love to talk about this because it's so important to mention, I think, in general, in today's world, this looking good may not always appeal to consumers.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
So it's actually come through a lot of testing of direct-to-consumer ads in Facebook and Instagram, TikTok. You can start to see a very big difference between that like really polished video with perfect lighting that there's like obviously was like 40 people on the set managing every little detail. It's been retouched perfectly to create this perfect moment. And what's happened now with marketing and advertising is that consumers are much more interested in scrolling with their thumb.
Right.
And when they see something that's just engaging enough to get them to stop, they will watch. I mean, some of us watch like 8-10 minute videos about the most random stuff. And you're like, what did I just do with my life for the last 10 minutes? And it could be the rawest, like most random video and you're like, how did that end up in my feed? And also why did I just watch it for 8 minutes? But it just kept me hooked the whole time. And we've all been there,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so as a result, you've got major multinational global brands needing to, you know, satisfy their internal teams, their legal teams, their marketing director, the global marketing director, and everyone's trying to keep everything on brand, and that's an important thing. I don't want to have a debate with the brand director about this, about being on brand. I think it's important. But what happens is like the world changed a lot in the last 4 or 5 years in the way we consume media. And what's like really natural and really kind of almost raw in the way you do it is really what has the potential to really scale sometimes viral. And brands are really struggling with this, especially global brands, because they still want to use big agency, the big shoot, the big creative director, and that video won't scale unless you put a lot of money behind it. You can force people to watch it, but then it's not really getting full views either. So we've been able to kind of mix and match the formula where, like you said, some ads we make are not the prettiest ads. Like some of them are quite ugly. Like one of our best performing, highest return on ad spend, or highest ROAS ad we have in the company, is a static image of a shabu shabu menu. And instead of having the meat on the menu like you would in Asia with like the trade up from the basic meat to the premium meat, we've replaced it all with underwear. Now, this advertisement resonates right away. People see it. They know it's a shabu shabu menu because it's exactly like a clone of a shabu shabu, but it's underwear. So it stops you in your tracks and you see this underwear ad. And it also is like, wow, I didn't know GQ had like 30 colors of underwear. And yeah, it's people click and then they go and they buy 3 or 5 pairs of underwear. And it's not even a video, but it's one of the best performing ads in the company. I was just at this Meta conference last week presenting, and a gentleman, Carlos, came up after me and presented. He shared all the trending data in Thailand, and like number 4 on the list was shabu shabu. And he's like, I don't know what happened. Is it trending because you guys been pushing it so hard with your ads, or was it trending? I said, no, I think it's like a perfect marriage.
Oh
where
my God.
We didn't even realize shabu shabu was trending. And then we have this ad that's all about shabu, and it's been a huge success. So, you know, the way you're going to find like really clever creative that can help you grow your brand and drive trial and conversion with consumers is really sometimes in the most unexpected ways. And this is one example where it's really been quite successful for us.
It's incredible. And I love that honesty in terms of not filtering, similar to your insights as well, like not filtering down good ideas and good creative thoughts to get a message out there from those who know the brand really well and can have a bit of fun with it. One thing I really wanted to talk about was this regular joke in the marketing world, which is the fear of being asked to make something go viral. It's one of the biggest challenges as a marketer, as a company that you may have, being asked to make something go viral. For you at GQ, viral is something that has come a lot of times for you, whereas for some brands, it may only come once or twice in its lifetime. How has this happened? You've had multiple product launches that have had, you know, video views of over 50 million video views. That could be more and counting. What is that secret? Is there a secret to the success of that? How does it happen? Help us.
Hold on. Let me check the secret book here. If I could share. Okay, I can share. No, it's like... It really is. I'd like to say it's a secret, but for us, it's not. I think that it's really more about brands and people putting this limitation on what they're willing to say and do. And look, we're very clear. Like, we're not going to cross a line that we feel like is inappropriate in our advertising, but some of the things that we do that works is a bit what I was talking about earlier, is we really take the original learning that really unlocked the whole original idea for the product. Like the two really good examples, one is the GQ CoolTech cooling underwear, right? And we learned very early on, which was part of the original insight wasn't like, okay, we need underwear that can cool you down in hot Bangkok. It was that actually that men were incredibly uncomfortable.
Whoa.
And they had been for decades and no one was talking about it, right? And so when we unlocked the conversation about the fact that men were uncomfortable all day and moving around in their seat and like, you know, whatever else was going on with their underwear, when we started to talk about this discomfort and that there was a better option, and it happened to be that we had underwear that could cool you down 2 degrees, it really was the part that unlocked the discussion. And the feature was the functional benefit for men, but it wasn't
that, just that. It was the brand acknowledgement. But when you went to go see the viral video, and I don't know if you see it, we can link it for the group, but it's very much like, it's very, very much like guys that were shifting in the conference room, other people looking at them going, I know you don't see me looking, but you're really kind of embarrassing yourself. And it was very real. And everything we said was real. It was like as if we taken the storyboard from the original qualitative insights and research and just slapped it onto the storyboard. And then we just made it funny with the cold eggs. And then this has been a repeatable model. And one of the things we talk about internally, we have this like mantra with everyone. It's like, make it a wow.
Ooh.
And you know, like when we show something in a room, whether it's a design or a new packaging or advertisement, if the room is not lit up going, wow, 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 then it's not a wow. And we're okay with that. We kind of say like, look, if it's not a wow, like let's go back and find another way to do it. And not everything is a wow or a hit, but to your point, we've been fortunate enough to have probably more viral videos than most. And I think it's been this like edge that we have with the brand. Now people are like expecting it a little bit, like, oh, here comes the next one. And we're like, you know, you don't want to let them down this launch. But it's sort of
no pressure.
Take it up a notch. No pressure at all.
What comes to mind when I think of you is this saying of, you know, if a flower doesn't bloom, you don't blame the flower, you blame the environment. And when I think of GQ and blooming, I think of the frameworks that you have around you. And I wonder, because it relates back to a conversation that we had earlier this year on one of our episodes with the deputy managing director of and a second generation leader of a family business in Thailand, Do Home. And they were celebrating this year 40 years of business. And when we were speaking, he spoke about how actually being in a family business is a superpower, because you can make fast decisions, you communicate quickly, and you just kind of keep moving. I'm wondering, from your point of view, although you may not be directly within the family of GQ, do you see that? Do you see that within the inner workings of the brand, the company, or what would you say to that?
I couldn't agree more with them. I think that a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people see a family business as a gross negative thing. They're like, oh, you're working in the family. What's that? What is that like? Is it hard? Thailand can be difficult sometimes. And I don't subscribe to it. I don't think that that's the case. Even when I'm talking at the university, like executive MBA program, you know, in those programs, 50, 60, 70% of the MBAs can be multi-generational, like second, third generation family business, the kids of these owners. And they're asking questions like, should I leave the family business and go start my own company? And I'm like, wow, you were really thinking about leaving. You know how many companies fail, startups, like really hard.
Yeah.
You know, the statistics around successful startups that don't go bankrupt are incredibly difficult. So transforming your family or the dynamic that's happening, in my view, is much easier than trying to start your own company. Something made them successful enough for you to be in this program today. With a little bit of effort, you can flip things around. And I think that your previous guest is correct that it is a superpower. It's the ability to be nimble and do things that others may not be able to do. And lots of brands, whether it's because they're maybe publicly traded, because they are a global brand, they're worried about their board of directors having an opinion, whatever their reasoning is for it, they do put this limitation on the business. And sometimes I think family businesses could actually have an advantage. And this is something that, you know, has become really apparent to me over the last, you know, year or so, trying to synthesize what we had done here. You know, I went out and worked with a really good friend of mine and now co-founder on this program, Fighting Giants, which we've talked about previously. And it's really about trying to help and create a community here in Thailand to help businesses
with the transformation. And it's for family businesses, but it's also, you know, people inside a big multinational, they're also really struggling with this transformation because there's so much pushing down on them from all different groups and departments that they lose this like innovative spirit, the superpower you're talking about. And it is an advantage for the family business, to your point, to be able to fight the bigger companies. So I think you're right in this approach.
And I'd like to go in on that then, this idea of the innovator of one and the work that you're doing with Fighting Giants. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, so thanks. So, you know, the two parts, like Steve McGinnis and I started Fighting Giants. Actually, it's just, we just sort of announced it, but we've been working on it for more than a year now. And we went out and we did these one-to-one interviews with executives and family business owners all across the region, not just in Thailand. And we started to see a convergence of the same problems, right? Executives were struggling with the things that they were losing touch with what's going on with the consumer. They can't get their teams to innovate. They also feel like they've lost an innovative edge. The internal culture could be quite hierarchical and dynamic. And it didn't matter if it was a big company or a small company. This dynamic was real across both. And so we built the Fighting Giants to help create this community where folks can come and share what's going on, and we can kind of help them along with this process. And it's meant to build this innovative culture spirit that's required to go out and do the innovation. Now, one of the parts that we talk about in Fight Giants is this idea of the innovator of one. And the innovator of one concept is just one of the modules. It's got six different modules that we've created. And the innovator of one's inside the innovation module. And this is really about asking executives to reconnect again. And when you say this on the surface, you're like, wow, that doesn't seem that like smart or brilliant at all. Like, you want me to reconnect? But I can tell you now, after being doing this for the last year and really now outwardly talking about Fighting Giants in the last 2 months, I have been in multiple rooms and multiple speeches across big companies like Meta. I was at Smart OSC. I was at retail and e-commerce executive meeting. We did 100 CEOs and MDs at the launch event for Fighting Giants. Every single time I'm like, how many people in the room have gone out and bought their product, used their service, or gone through their customer's journey in the last month? And on average, it's like 4 or 7 people. So like less than 10% of the room usually has even gone through their customer journey. Many of them are like, I've never even done it. Like my favorite one is the hotel owner who's never stayed in his hotel. He said, oh, one time I stayed in it, but I told him I was coming already and they rolled out the red carpet. And you're like, oh, that's not the same experience as me going there and queuing up and waiting and sitting in the lobby for my key and like get to the room and the aircon's dripping. You know, it's like totally different experience for me. But so we're just asking the executives and these heads to go in and like, why don't you just be consumer for a day, get closer to your team? If you run an, you know, supply chain operation, go to your warehouse and work in the warehouse for a day. Be a bit of like what we call like undercover boss, and don't do it. Don't announce. So people are like, oh, I go to market visits all the time. Do you tell them you're on the way? Yeah, I tell them in advance. So this like, okay, well, everything always looks perfect because they sweep all the stores you're going to visit and make it look perfect. It's like, just show up and see what happens. And it's a totally different experience. And so, you know, that's one example of like reconnecting with the user that we talk about. The second part is like, bit of what we talked about in this session too, is like this innovation at every touch point. So it's like innovating in the way you're getting involved with the consumer, you know, the insights, how you build the product out and your service, going through that customer journey. How does every little, whether it's packaging, the website, every little detail matters. The phone call, how the voice sounds in your customer service team when they answer. All of that like really matters. And if you can be close to all those touch points and make each one a wow or a slight twist, it all like stacks up to create a highly distinct brand in the market. And one of the parts, the last part is the idea of like creating an army of ones or an army of innovator of ones. But I don't think you can do the third one yet until you get yourself sorted. And this is what I tell folks when we meet. I say, look, you haven't earned the right to create an army, or your team can't be super innovative if you're not doing it yourself as a leader. And so my ask to them is to go reconnect, you know, get closer to the consumer, figure out what's really going on. It'll be eye-opening, and it always is for them to do it. Don't use a research report. Don't filter it. Just go and do it. And if you do that and you get to a point where that's working, then you can repeat it with your team and ask them to do it. But until you go and do it yourself, you can't really be an innovator of one or an army of ones until you become one yourself. And as we've gone through this journey with leaders, they've been like really, it's been inspiring for me to see their feedback where they're like, I thought that was a pretty basic principle, but I realized I wasn't doing it anymore. It's been a really long time. And I went and did it, and I was shocked at what I learned. I was blown away at how much work needs to happen with our sales process, or how little people are interacting in meetings. When I really stopped to listen for a minute, I realized that there weren't questions being asked, that I haven't created a safe enough environment to foster innovation. And so all these things have factored in to trying to create, you know, folks that are fighting inside the giant, or they're fighting from outside, and they're fighting from you know, small company or family business fighting a giant. It doesn't matter. Both of them are in a different fight, but a fight nevertheless.
A fight with themselves as well too, right? Like it's kind of stepping outside of yourself, changing your mindset, going from that fixed perspective to a growth perspective as well, and allowing yourself to be okay with seeing things as they are and not just presuming that things are running smoothly and that things are perfect. I think that's really lovely as well. It's like, okay, it's fine. You'll be empowered by that down the line, but you have to face it in order to keep moving forward, which I really like as well.
I think that's true. You know, just add one piece. I think that sometimes at the executive level, and it's not talked about enough, that, you know, it can be quite lonely sometimes too at the top. And and there's this need sometimes where you're in a role, you feel like you have to say something and you feel like you need to add value in a room with 12 people in it because you're the sort of big boss, especially in Asia, right? And in reality, it'd be better if you just were quiet and you just ask questions and listened for the whole time. Actually, one of the tricks is a very simple technique that we ask the Fighting Giants community to do is like, next week, go to a meeting and go through the whole meeting and don't speak. Very few of them can do this. And it's not because people keep asking them questions. It's because they've programmed themselves that they have to be the one talking all the time. But if you do it a few times where you go and you just listen to what's being said and you engage and you're not on your phone the whole meeting, you will find that people are saying things that are quite relevant. And just like, tell me more about that. Like, what's happening? Like, look, just ask really engaging questions and don't speak. Don't judge. Don't react. You know, don't, someone says, I just don't understand our strategy here at the company. You just want to get defensive because you kind of were the one who wrote the strategy, rather than saying like, tell me more about like why you don't understand it. And if you can do that, if you can just listen, then you get so much more out of the conversations with your teams. And the same goes with the consumer. Like, executives are notorious. We go out to the user says, well, you know, your product's like, you know, it's kind of rubs against my skin a little bit and makes me itchy. And then you want to get really defensive. Well, we're using Supima cotton and the finest fibers, and they're organic and sustainable, or blah, 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 blah. All this jargon. Consumers like, yeah, but my skin's still itchy.
Yeah, they don't know. As a consumer, you don't know all of these things.
Consumer doesn't care about what kind of cotton it is and what you used in your double twisting manufacturing process and all these factory talk that we talk. Consumer is just like, yeah, I just wanted to feel nice against my skin. Like, can you just get me that? And so just go and listen and understand what they're meaning. And this can go a really long way with your work.
I think, you know, you answered one of my final questions for you, which was, you know, what are the core traits of a leader that may do well for the future world that we're going into? And I think that listening point is so, so important. So important. Just actively listening and creating those safe spaces, as you mentioned earlier, for innovation and for ideas to be shared and to feel safe within that creative burst as well within a company.
Aziza, I think you mentioned the word safe a few times, right? And we kind of touched on it earlier, but someone asked me, like, what is the core of how you've been able to unlock the innovation at TQ? And Wynn is very good at this, our CEO as well. It's just creates a psychologically safe environment for the teams, right? Including me too, right? It's like he and the team, when we're together, people feel like they can really say what they want to say without risk of fear or shame or failure. And there's many failures we've had along the way. And we've said, look, what did you learn from it?
Yeah.
Like, it didn't work. Yeah, it was a mess. So what went wrong? So we don't do it again, or it's a teachable moment for people. And this psychological safety creates an environment where when we move on to the next big innovation, people aren't hesitating out of fear of worrying about, well, what if I repeat the last failure, right? They don't think of it that way. They say, look, yeah, it didn't work out, but time to move on to the next one and take the learnings from that to the next chapter of whatever we're doing. And this is so important. You asked, like, what's one of the key parts of good leadership, and particularly in Thailand and in Asia, with a hierarchical structure, younger individuals or people at mid-level roles, they don't feel like they can really voice their opinion in meetings out of, well, maybe I should tell my direct manager, who then will tell their direct manager, will then tell the boss that he or she is maybe going down the wrong path. And that doesn't get happen. We have associate brand new hires that will stop me and the CEO in a meeting and say, hey, I just think that this doesn't make sense. And I'm like, all right, well, me as a leader needs to not react. Just say, okay, well, tell me why you feel that way. And I might agree with you. I might have to re-explain the position of why we're doing it, why it makes sense. Someone could say to me, well, I just don't understand why now we don't just start doing a lot of collections and become a fashion brand because we built the brand back up. And I'm like, well, because that's not the strategy. That's not what we decided to do. That's not the wedge we created in the market. But they might come in thinking, I want to be a big fashion brand because it's ingrained in their head, And it's like, well, that's just not what we're going to do. That's not what we're all about. So that these are the kind of things that, you want to listen, create a psychologically safe environment, and then hopefully the teams are able to thrive and grow.
Now, with looking at the future as well, my last question, I promise, just looking at how close you get to customers, the insights you gain, do you think in the future GQ will get to a place where you'll be able to maybe predict the needs or problems before they even come to fruition? And will this kind of approach fit in with future brand strategies and innovations?
Ooh, yeah, that's a good one. I don't know. I don't know if we'll be able to get to the point where we're able to fully predict what people are doing. And the reason is, one of the other fundamental principles that I believe in, there's a really great book from Steven Johnson called Where Good Ideas Come From. And I don't know if you've read it, but it's really talks about something called the adjacent possible. And the belief of the adjacent possible is really that most businesses, brands, people are truly not inventors. Most of the things that have happened in life were never really inventions. Even the iPhone that everyone's like, Apple's the best, Apple, Steve Jobs, right? Apple's an amazing brand, but they didn't invent anything with the iPhone. Everything that they put together and packaged up was already, again, readily available technology in the world. They just happened to bundle it a lot better and do a really great job marketing it, right? And so for us, it's less about trying to be so predictive that we can predict what people will want next, rather than being the fastest at seeing what's taking the problems and then seeing what's readily available and synthesizing that and then putting great marketing around it with good distribution online and offline, and then letting consumers enjoy what we've built. And that, for us, that we believe that's a better model than maybe trying to predict an invention that we can't think of at this point, or we don't try to get ahead of what consumers might not even realize they want yet. That's very difficult. This happens
literally once in a lifetime for some really great, great inventor. But for us, it's just about synthesizing innovation.
That's great. That's brilliant. And I think with that, I'm going to say thank you so much for your time today, George. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and really, really enjoyed the questions.